welcome.
Okay, thank you. I was going to say that there should be a sort of a different dimension on your charts, because physicists are working in this field, and you will see that I tend to take the point of view of physics very, very much. However, I'm going to talk about some themes that were mentioned by previous speakers, and particularly the speaker that just finished about. I'm going to be talking about 3D collagen experiments associated with brain tumors, in particular glioma. So let me just briefly. By the way, this is going to be very elementary. It's because it's the best I can do, and I am not a cancer expert. I'm a physicist, and I'm going to try to emphasize the physical properties of the microenvironment of glioma tumors, which might be relevant to eventually to treatment. These are my collaborators, two of whom are here. Here is just some brief things about glioma. Everyone knows about this particular disease right now because Ted Kennedy has it, unfortunately. It's a terrible thing, and here are the terrible news about highly malignant gliomas in the brain, in particular GBM, which is what we're going to talk about. This is the interesting point. There's no significant advances, despite the enormous advances which have been made in the treatment of cancer in the last decades. Glioma is basically where we were 30 years ago or more, and the reason for that is well known. It has to do with this quote from ancient times that Siv gave us, namely that when you cut out a glioma tumor like this one here, you have to cut into the healthy tissue around the tumor because the tumor is highly invasive. And unfortunately, that doesn't work. That doesn't work because you can't cut out enough, because it's your brain. And there has been, in the 1930s, before present ethical standards were established, there was an attempt to actually get rid of the invasive nature of glioma in the following way. Glioma, as we'll see, it invades. There's a visible tumor, and then there are cells that move out in the ECM of the brain. And there was a gentleman who simply excised the whole hemisphere of the brain, and took it out, and you can survive that more or less. And the people died anyway, because these cells are so invasive, they go across the corpus callosum and infect the other side. So we have a terrible situation, so terrible that the NIH is willing to support a theoretical physicist, which is a desperation measure if there ever was one. Now, let me tell you a little about what happens. Here is the tumor, and here is the using the ancient methods of taking out more than you can see. You have excised a big part of the brain, and 8 months later, this part up here gets infected. And the problem is not only does this tumor spread, it spreads in ways that are unpredictable. The surgeons that I talked to about this particular tumor would have thought it would go this way, and it went up that way, and they don't know why, and nothing is really known about this. So we're interested in examining the fundamentals of the situation, and there are various in vitro models that one can think of for dealing with the in vitro and in vivo models that one can think of in dealing with this situation. One of which is simply to put the glioma cells on a slide and watch them move around, and they're very motile, and that's of course the whole point of the exercise. And there are various kinds of cells where you can see cell motility, and you can look in mice and in people's brains. But we're going to be interested in a particular kind of three-dimensional assay of the type mentioned by the previous speaker. We put a clump of cultured tumor cells, a tumor spheroid, into a gel. We use collagen 1, and the reason for that, even though collagen 1 is a bad model for the brain, there's a reason for that, and that's that we can image the collagen fibers, so we can see both the fibers and the cells. And here is an example of the spheroid growing, and here is a reference, if you're interested, of one of my collaborators, Tom Dysbuck, and his lab. Now, actually happens is the following. Here's a nice movie. This is actually not in collagen 1, but in Matrigel. And you can see here's the tumor spheroid. And look at this little guy up here. That's a bugger that's going to cause all the trouble. It's going to, see, it got loose. And those, presumably, we believe that if this is a good model, this is what happens in the brain. That is to say, cells detach from the tumor wander around in the extracellular matrix, which is a kind of gel of exactly the kind we're talking about, and form secondary tumors, and those ones always form nearby to the tumor that you can take out with surgery, and eventually you just lose the battle and lose the patient. And so that's the issue. That's the issue we want to pursue. Now, how do we do it? Well, we have an experiment which we can look at in enormous detail. And this talk is going to be about what we can learn by looking in enormous detail what happens. In particular, we can do confocal microscopy on the cells, which are labeled with gene, green fluorescent protein, and look at cell tracts. And here are tracts of individual cells over a period. This is the inside is over a period of 24 hours, and then this is starting at 48 hours and going out. And we can look at the tracts and analyze just what are these guys doing. And from the point of view of the physicist, we just ask, what's the motion? Now, that's a physicist, right? What's the motion? What's going on with the cells? What's the kind of dynamics that we're interested in, that we see? And Casey, my student, Snyder Mizell, made this beautiful picture in three dimensions of the way that the cells actually move. These are individual cell tracts. And this wonderful globe is the tumor spheroid. It's not a picture of the tumor spheroid. So it gives you an idea. It gives you an idea of what's going on. Now, here is what we find when we analyze the cell tracts in detail. And we analyze it in the simplest way that we can. We see that the cells are biased random walkers. Now, it's important, the bias is important, because it wasn't evident. You could imagine, and in fact some models which are due to Jim Murray and Kristen Swanson, imagine that the cells are simply diffusing objects, that they're simply random walkers. And in the microenvironment, at different scales from what Murray and Swanson were interested in, this is completely not true. They are not random walkers. They shoot away from the tumor spheroid at enormous, on these scales, at enormous velocities. They are radially expelled from the tumor spheroid. And we show that by the following method. We simply analyze the motion. We know everything. We can see the cell tracks. So we can know everything. And what we find is kind of interesting. In this particular cell line, which is U87 delta EGFR culture glioma cells, we find that over the first day there is a quite large radial velocity and a random azimuthal velocity. So you have the tumor, things are moving out and sort of wandering around. After a couple of days, the radial velocity decays. We don't know why. We're going to try to understand a little bit about that. But the radial velocity decays and the azimuthal velocity continues to be random. Okay, so what's going on? What's going on? So let's see. And we can make histograms. We look at the average radial bias as the function of time from the start of the experiment, and here we can see the decay again quantitatively over a population. So we can also look over at population studies. We can do population studies for longer times to see what's happening to the cells in aggregate. This is simply bright field microscopy studies of the whole pattern of all the cells. Those dots are cells. Okay? Each one is an individual cell. This has been published in Biophysical Journal, if you're interested. And what we see, if you look at the top, in a particular cell line, U87 wild type, we see an expanding cloud of cells, which presumably has something to do with what happens in the brain, with the invasion process in the brain. That's the kind of thing we're interested in. Now, this cell line has a a mutated EGF receptor on its surface, which is constitutively active, and that mutation is associated with higher malignancy in vivo. So we looked at this cell line, we find apparently paradoxical results. There's less invasion. That's exactly what we don't expect. But we also see these things, these clumps. So I'm not going to talk about this, but we have tried to analyze this in terms of cell-cell adhesion. We think that cell-cell adhesion is upregulated in this guy and compared to that guy. And these things may give us some clue of secondary tumors. Okay, so also, you can understand from a purely physical point of view, it's undoubtedly too naive, but it's the point of view I like to take, if you can understand the lack of the lower shed rate for this cell line. Because what is happening when a cell is shed from a tumor, there is a competition between cell-cell adhesion and cell matrix adhesion. And if the cell-cell adhesion is upregulated, you would expect less shed rate, and that's exactly what we see here. And we're following that kind of line to see if we can understand the shed rate patterns in terms of these ideas. Okay, now, so let's see what we get. What's the kind of thing that we get? Well, cell tracking and population tracking show that the shells are shed from the spheroid. As I've already said, that the rate presumably depends on a competition, a mechanical competition, between cell-cell adhesion and cell matrix adhesion. We see some random motion, not very much, and we see this directed motion. We see this directed motion away from the spheroid at 10 microns per hour, roughly speaking. Okay, that's the kind of thing that we're going to try to understand. Now, this note I just added because Siv mentioned targeted therapies, and we have gone down that line to some extent too, because we think the invasion is this kind of thing that you might like to try to target. We're trying to understand the invasion, and we have found in particular that a well-known drug that people use for brains, which gets into the brain, lithium chloride, actually inhibits invasion of glioma cells. So it might be an interesting thing to follow. Unfortunately, if you want to inhibit invasion enough to actually do anything, it kills the mouse. And you don't want to do that. So, but anyway, it might give some clue to a kind of therapy which we could eventually pursue. Okay, so let's go back to the fundamentals of the microenvironment. What is going on? Why are these cells moving out, expelled from the tumor? What exactly is happening? It presumably has something to do with the extreme invasiveness of this cancer in vivo. And, so there are some things that you might guess. The first guess would be there's chemotaxis. That is to say that for some reason the cells don't like the environment of the tumor. There may be waste products or something, lack of oxygen, and they want to follow a chemical gradient outward. Or it may be that they're starved, because there are lots of glioma cells gathered together in the tumor spheroid. They're starved, so there's a gradient of nutrient coming in from the outside. There's nutrient in these experiments. There's all kinds of medium to keep the cells alive, and presumably it's depleted in the region around the spheroid, so that the cells would like to go away and get fed. That's the idea. And then there's a possibility of cell matrix interactions, which I'll put down there, and you'll see why in a moment. Okay, so let's do a little mathematics. There's kind of mathematics we can all do in our heads. Suppose we have I just told you about solutions to the diffusion equation. How do you solve the diffusion equation? You have a sink, and you have diffusion, then near the sink, there's less stuff, yes? And there's a gradient going outward. Everyone agree? Okay, now suppose you have two tumor spheroids, one here and one here. Yes? Okay. Now, what about between them? What do you expect? You expect the nutrient to be completely depleted between them, yes? And so all the cells will go out that way. Everybody agree? Okay. All right, let's see what actually happens. This is an... Say it again? No, they're not purely diffusing. We believe there's directed motion. There's chemotaxis. I'm talking about something where the diffusion is a minor component. It's the directed motion that's a major thing. Okay, in that case, what you're saying, of course, is right. If it's purely diffusion, we get more in between. But if you're following some gradient, the gradients are small between the two tumor spheres. And that's, of course, the reason I bring that up is it's wrong. This is an experiment done by accident. Two tumor spheroids were put by David Vader into the experimental cell. Here's one up there, and there's one down there. And here you can see the power of the technique. We can see both the tumor, the fibers, so the red things, the fibers of the collagen, and the green cells, and the cells concentrate between the spheroids, just where they should not be. Okay? So it can't be chemotaxis, or it can't only be chemotaxis, is our claim. Okay? Because there's just no way you get this pattern. Now, this is not a biologically relevant pattern. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't believe that this is the issue in the brain, but I believe that this gives you some insight into what's actually happening. So what do we think is happening? We think that the fibers between the spheroids are aligned. There's another experiment by someone else about alignment of fibers between spheroids. Why is that? It's because if you have a tumor spheroid, have a bunch of tumor cells, they attach to the matrix. I've already said that. And they pull on it. And if you have somebody here and somebody here pulling, in between the fibers get stretched out and are straight. And if they're straight, they make a kind of highway along which the cells can crawl. Okay? So you enhance the motility along the fibers, and that's what we believe happens, and we believe with around a single spheroid, and we're doing experiments. My collaborators are doing experiments now to see how this goes. We have substantial radial alignment around the single spheroid. And we'll see some indirect evidence for that in a moment. Okay, so let's talk a little about matrix interactions. Some of these have already been mentioned. There are MMPs that can degrade the matrix and change motility of cells. Cells can produce collagen. We're going to be interested in these things, that the cells can deform the matrix, align the matrix, make all kinds of things happen for them in the matrix. And that's the kind of thing we'd like to talk about. So, does it happen? Well, here, can you see this? Here, these are fibers right here. And here's a cell. And it's pulling pretty hard. You see those cones, these things. That's the kind of thing we're going to try to be interested in. So what do we do? We're interested in collagen, okay? The particular kind of collagen we're interested in is collagen 1, which, as I say, is not the thing that you really want to be interested in, but it's nice to work with. And it's of interest because it's a very common biopolymer, and we can deal with it and maybe even have some ideas, which will transcend cancer studies. We can get some ideas about collagen. Okay, so here's collagen. You make some polymer, and you wrap it up into three, and then you wrap the three into some big bundle, hundreds of these threefold fibrils are wrapped together in a fiber. Okay, and those fibers are very stiff, and they're unlike other biopolymers that you may be familiar with, like actin, because they are very stiff. The persistence length of these polymers, the length over which they bend spontaneously is larger than the experiment. Okay? So we can think of them as elastic beams. Okay? They are not, they don't have any entropic effects that are important. Okay? Everything's mechanics. That's our claim. we'll see things that look like things that you may have seen associated with, say, actin, which is semi-flexible, are completely flexible things, but they are different in principle. Okay, so here's the gel. Here is visualized by confocal microscopy. Here's what it looks like. These are the fibers, and you're seeing them, and here's the scale. That's the kind of thing we're after. Now, other people have thought about this issue, and there's a lot of things that you can say about it. Here is the kind of collagen we're interested in. It comes from cows. It's very similar to what you eat when you eat Jell-O. This is exactly the stuff you're all familiar with. The stuff we're interested in is more or less mechanically like Jell-O that you eat. The other experiments have been done on Matrigel, which is difficult to see under confocal microscopy, so we don't like to use it, but some of the experiments have been done on Matrigels. It's a more common medium for putting cells in. Okay, so here is the issue. Here is what we're going to be interested in. And so we're going to try to understand this fundamentally. A lot of people, as has been mentioned, are interested in this kind of experiment, so let's see if we can understand the setting of the experimental of the experiments that people do for these 3D assays. So here is the issue. Yes. It's a solid, right? Okay, it's crossing, and that'll come up. That's very important. Okay, what do you do if you're a physicist? Well, you measure some physical properties. So this has nothing to do with cancer cells. It's just a sample of collagen, and we do some stress-strain relation measurements. And here's how they look, and it's kind of an interesting thing. Here is the elastic regime. You can hardly see it. Look, we all know this. Collagen is in your skin. You know, if you pull your skin a little, it's sort of floppy, and you pull it a lot, it's kind of hard to pull. Huh? Right, that's what we're interested in. And so we have this region called the toe, where this is the real elastic regime, small strain regime. And then here is a nonlinear elasticity regime, this region here, and then you have failure. Now, this picture, if I didn't put labels on this picture, this picture would look like almost any biopolymer. They all look like this. Actin looks like this, other things look fibronectin. They all have these mechanical properties. And we'd like to understand where they come from. And does it have anything to do with alignment? Does it have anything to do with the microenvironment of the tumor spheroid? That's the idea. Okay, so here it is, what we're trying to figure out. Well, mathematicians would do this a way that I don't understand, because I'm not a mathematician. A mathematician would take this problem and say, well, you know, you have an elasticity strain tensor. We also have an alignment tensor, and so you have to couple those two tensors and make all kinds of compatibility arguments and do a lot of topology and stuff, and I don't understand any of that. And furthermore, I don't think it's relevant because we're interested in scales on the order of the mesh size of the gel, which is on about a micron. We're interested in scales 10 to 100 microns. So we're going to take the fact that this is composed of individual fibers quite seriously. So we're simply going to take the network, and we're going to try to understand it from the confocal images. We're going to model the fibers in the traditional way as simply beams. Now, what's a beam? It's something that bends, right? And Euler understood this many, many years ago, and the important thing about a beam is that if it's longer, it's floppier, and if it's thicker, it's stiffer. Yeah, and that's all you have to know. Its stiffness goes up like the fifth power of the fourth power, I forget. Anyway, we did it right. My student did it right. Of the radius, and that's what we have to know, and then we're going to try to compare it to data, and then we're going to try to do something about cells. Okay, so here's the network. What's different about this approach from previous approaches is that we have actually taken the real structure of the network seriously. Could I have the lights off? I think it would be easier to see a little bit if there were fewer lights on the screen. Okay, so, well, maybe not. Ah, good. Okay, so you can see all these, you know, this collection of fibers. And what we want to know is, what is the network there in three-dimensional space? This is so. The first issue is, what's the network? Here is what the eventual result. Here's the network that we extract. And how do we do that? So we're going to try to figure it out, and here's what we did. And this has been, will come out soon, is a way to extract the three-dimensional structure of networks from confocal images. Again, it's a nice algorithm. And a program we can send you if you're interested. Okay, here's how it works. I'm going to go quickly because I'm running out of time. Here is the image, which we threshold to make it white and black. And then we try to, and here's what the image actually looks like. These are the whiteness, of the image. And then you find points which are the local maxima, and you, I'm going the wrong way. That's why it's not working. You then put boxes around them and connect them with lines, and then you extend and so forth. And obviously, I'm not going to go into great detail, but we can figure out an algorithm which works and is associated with a program that we have in order to make the image. And the question is, is it a good algorithm? Okay. Well, we took some artificial networks where we actually know where everything is, and we tried to do some of the steps in our algorithm and extracted reasonable, I'm flashing through this, you can't possibly understand this, but we extract reasonable estimates for the total length of the fibers, and importantly, the density of cross links. And the cross links are going to come back, they're important. What's a cross-link? For the non-cognoscenti, you have a fiber, and there are some extra covalent bonds between the fibers, and they link together, because otherwise you would just have the liquid, right? Now you have actual chemical bonds, covalent bonds between the fibers. And the question that we're going to be interested in is, how much can you deform? It turns out to be the essential question, how much you can deform this cross-link. Okay, so this is just a repeat of something you've already seen applied to an actual network. And so how do we do this? This is a submitted paper, which exists in a preprint, which I'll be happy to send to people, of how we actually do this. We think that we have a bunch of elastic beams. We attach them to walls and let the nodes attached to the walls slide, and then we attach to the other wall, and that's how we do the elasticity, and we impose a displacement. That's it. Okay, now, minimize the energy, of course. That's how you do a problem like this. And here's the kind of thing we're going to see. Okay, this is the actual dynamics of one of these networks. Now, how do you mechanically model a fiber? That's what I already mentioned. That's Lenny Euler. You write down some form, you locate it, and then you say that it has a certain amount of stretch energy, a certain amount of bend energy, and the stretch energy comes from ordinary things that you know from, this is this fourth power I mentioned, and you can find the stretch energy and the bend energy. And then we model the crosslinks. How do we model the crosslinks? We model them with a spring. Okay? We say that these, and we'll see why in a minute, that these crosslinks are deformable in the sense that they can turn, but not break. Okay? And so here is the model for the crosslinks. Minimize the total energy. And here's why we have to model the crosslinks that way. If we want to model this elastic region, I emphasize, this is the small strain region. This is what happens when you just pull a little. And if you had freely rotating crosslinks, which some authors have assumed, the real networks, because we know what the real networks is, are unstable. They have no elastic properties at all. So it can't be that. My first guess was that these crosslinks are welded. Well, that gives far too large a modulus. And so we use the Goldilocks principle. Somewhere between too much and too little is just right. And so we fit the crosslink, the one parameter in the theory, that's all. The one parameter in theory is this this strength of the crosslink, and we can fit for we can fit for various collagen densities. And what we find is something kind of interesting, that as you might have guessed from the picture I showed you originally, when you deform these networks initially, until you get way out into this toe region, into this this nonlinear region, all of the energy goes into bending and very little into stretching. Okay? If it goes into bending and not stretching, the network deforms in shape. It's called non-affine. Okay? Any simple assumption that the deformations are affine, little rectangles turn into, you know, deformed rectangles, is just wrong. So it's non-affine deformations. And what is happening is these things are straightening out. Okay? And so here's some experiments. And here are some results of the modeling. Here is the extraction of the network with the ends taken out so that you don't worry about the stuff that just flops around freely. Here's under 50% tension, 50% shear. Okay? Those are pictures of what we compute. And here is a comparison between experiment and theory. Here's the elastic regime, here's the inelastic regime, and I submit that's pretty good. One parameter. The one parameter fits this, and then the rest gets fit. And it fits over a wide range of collagen densities with the same parameter. Okay? And so here are some more details. And you can see something here which is interesting. Suppose we assume that the crosslinks are in fact floppy. Okay? So the only restoring force was the springs, the stretching of the fibers. That doesn't fit at all down here in the small strain regime, and it does fit in the large strain regime. It's exactly what you expect. And everything has a nice data collapse, which I won't go into. Okay, so everything seems sort of nice, that we can understand the elasticity, the nonlinear elasticity of this gel. Now, what good is that? Okay, so now we get into some details which are a little bit complicated, and this is work in progress. Once we know that there's alignment, we believe that we have an account for the motion of the cells along these oriented fibers. Now, qualitatively that's okay. In detail, that's somewhat complicated, because if you're going to actually do cell motility experiments, what almost everyone does is do cell motility experiments on top of something. But here we're embedded in a three-dimensional object, and we don't quite know what to do. Furthermore, I think I'll draw on the blackboard. There are all these chalk, you know, is the symbol of the Fields Institute. So I think I'll draw on the blackboard if I can find some room. Let me show you the next slide, and then I'll draw something on the blackboard. What we're going to try to do now is put in the cells. Okay, so we're going to go back to think about the three-dimensional assay. We're going to talk about how do the cells move. Well, the cells, we know from other experiments, pull on the matrix. Okay? And so we treat them as a force monopole or a force dipole. They just pull. Okay, what we'd like to see is, if we have this tumor spheroid, it's pulling in on all the fibers in its vicinity and orienting them. But that orientation can't go on forever. What we'd like to know is how far out does that orientation propagate? And that'll give us some idea of what local versus global behavior for cell motility. and we can't do that yet. But let me just say something about what we think is going to happen. Let me do it here. Here's what we're going to try to do. We're going to consider the alignment experiment, the two-spheroid experiment I talked about. Treat the edge of the spheroid as a plane for simplicity. Figure out the force, which is exerted on the network by measurements on single cells. This is using this work from Vernita Gordon and collaborators in 2003. And then use our program to see if the cells are pulling enough. Now, of course, this is something which could fail. That is to say, if we take the realistic measurements of the strength of these cells, 100 nanonewtons, 10 to 100 nanonewtons, how much they pull, okay, and we put it into our program, it could be that it's just a trivial force and doesn't do anything. Or it could be it just tears the network apart. What we find is neither. We find exactly what we hope to find here. We find that if this is an unstressed network, that one of the planes is here and the other plane is over there, yes? And when you align, you see this kind of alignment of fibers, exactly what we saw in the two-spheroid experiment. Now, that's good, but it's not good enough, because suppose we have a tumor spheroid, and we're aligning like this, and we're aligning like this, and we're aligning like this, okay? Well, you notice that the cells, that the fibers get more dense. But yes, you don't recruit new fibers. So if the fibers get dense here, they must make holes here. Yes? And we are at least considering the possibility that these are the pathways that the cells explore when they move outward. In other words, that you make the microenvironment around the tumor spheroid a kind of porous medium in which the cells can propagate easily. And that is a way to have things that are less, it's a purely mechanical way to see something, to see a large effect on cell motility. Now, I'm representing my bias, of course. I'm a physicist. That's the kind of explanation I'd like to look for, and I hope it's part of the truth. So here's some conclusions. We can do micromechanical modeling in 3D collagen networks. We have a single parameter. Here it is. It agrees with experiment of small strains and large strains. It's small deformation. The energy is in bending. Highly non-affine. Cells of measured strength of cells of glioma cells that we've actually worked with are in the region to get you into the nonlinear regime, which is what we wanted. And here's my final conclusions. There's a lot of physics, at least. I think there's a lot of biology that I don't know anything about. The cell motility depends on the matrix interactions. I think that's very important. Yeah, I mean, it's well known. It's well known that far from tumors, glioma cells move along pathways that are preformed, like white matter, axon sheaths and things like that. The corpus callosum is a bunch of pathways for the cells. It's a bunch of bundles of axons and blood vessels that go between the two hemispheres. And in fact, and that's what I mentioned early on, the motility between the two hemispheres is enormous. It's enormous because of that. And that's the same effect. That's the same effect that we have been talking about. We can extract networks from confocal data, and we can model the mechanics. Thank you for your attention.